Do you invest in ETFs? Whether you're thinking, what in the world is an ETF? Or you're looking for the next opportunity to add to your portfolio. GlobalX has you covered. From big tech to bonds and bars of gold, GlobalX offers a wide range of exchange-traded funds. Go beyond ordinary with GlobalX ETFs. Visit globalxetfs.com.au. That's globalxetfs.com.au. I am so excited to tell you that InvestSmart and Intelligent Investor are long-term sponsors of this podcast. And here's something I want to tell you about. The Intelligent Investor Select Value Fund is a unique mix of global leaders and homegrown small caps poised for long-term growth. The portfolio manager is Nathan Bell, a talented investor you may have heard on the RAST network multiple times. The Select Value Fund is designed for investors seeking international diversification and Aussie companies with superior financial metrics. You can invest today at intelligentinvestor.com.au/IISV-offer. That's intelligentinvestor.com.au/IISV-offer. Hey there, here's a quick note. This podcast contains general financial advice only. That means it's not specific to you, your needs, goals, or objectives, so don't act on the information until you've spoken with your financial advisor. You'll find our full disclosure, disclaimer, and link to our financial services guide in the show notes. This episode of the podcast was recorded at the Australian Shareholders Association Sydney Conference. So if you hear people chattering or maybe even a bell or some plates and cutlery, you know what it is. It's a bit of background noise. Try to tune that out. We've done our best with editing. Hopefully one day you'll see us on the road in a city near you. Keep your eyes peeled on the RAST Media website for any updates for events that we'll be hosting in the back half of the year. But in the meantime, you can enjoy this episode and know that it was done in real life. Thanks for listening. Well, this is a special episode for me. We're recording at the Australian Shareholders Association, and I have three people with a wealth of experience across different verticals. There are some similarities here. I'm looking at you, Andrew. I'm looking at you, Dania. And Angus, thank you all for joining me here for this very special episode at the ASA conference in Sydney. Angus, I thought maybe we could start with you and maybe an intro to you, but also the business and what you do. I guess, what's a typical day look like for you managing such a large portfolio that's been going for such a long time?
Yeah, so Whitefield or Whitefield Industrials has been around for 100 years now. We invest in a portfolio of Australian shares. It's diversified. There are around 160 stocks, and that investment universe is ASX 200 Industrials, which is all sectors of the market ex resources. So one of the nice little tilts in there at the moment is the fact that we've got a 60% lower carbon emissions intensity than the broad market.
What does it mean to you to have to be in charge of a business, an investing business that's been around for 100 years?
I don't think the fact it's been around 100 years changes our mindset at all. It's more the other way around, that we've had a mindset for a long period of time that's really the cause of longevity and durability of the investment structure. And look, I was thinking hard about what the contributors to that, and at least one of them, which is often overlooked, is ownership or co-ownership. So throughout the entire 100 years, our handful of chief executives and chairman as well have also all been very big investors in the fund itself. And I think that brings with it a huge alignment of interest. Management are our shareholders. You know, they're the same as every other investor. And that means it's not important. We're not just thinking about 3 years or 4 years or 5 years. It's no good to us if we generate good returns for 3 years and blow it up in the fourth or fifth. You know, we've got to generate good returns over 10 years, 20, 30, 40, 50. It's what matters to us. It's what matters to our investors. And I think that so that real alignment of interest and ownership stake does give us this background mindset oriented towards longevity. And that then governs the strategies that we adopt, the processes we use, and the type of people that we bring into the business to work with us.
There is a good example, like just like this longevity is so important, right? Because many investors react to the market volatility and market noise. And there is a book written by, you know, a high caliber investor more based on the US market. And he did the analysis on S&P 500 that if over the period of 20 years, you missed or you were out of the market at least one day a month, your return would be approximately 1%. If you stayed consistently in the market for 20 years, your return would be approximately 7%.
Yeah, look, we've been thinking hard about this, you know, reflecting on the 100 years. But one of the things, again, it's overlooked. You don't think about this unless you're looking at a long time frame. But and we've had some investors there for 100 years or investor families. But if your investment has durability and lasts for 100 years, the investors had to make one correct investment decision and incurred one set of costs in setting that up. Now, in contrast, if your fund's much less durable or you need to chop and change it more often, and say on average your fund only lasted 5 years or you change your investment every five, you've incurred 20 times of selling costs, buying costs, taxation costs, research costs, and time out of the market, which is what you're alluding to before. So multiplied 20 times over, it can actually trim a fair bit out of investment value. So durability of the structure itself definitely has value.
Absolutely. And we'll come back to that, actually. That's a really good point, which we'll come back to towards the end. Andrew, we might switch gears and bring you into the conversation here. Not many people maybe have heard you on the show, given this is your first appearance. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and the business that you set up? And I'm also curious and hoping that you can explain, just to set the scene, what private debt is and the role that it plays in the market and portfolios.
Sure. Thanks, Owen. So my name is Andrew Lockhart. I spent 26 years working for National Australia Bank. In 2013, Metrics launched its first fund. So we've now been operating for 10 years. Our role is to originate, to structure, to manage risk associated with directly lending to Australian and New Zealand-based companies. And so the market is predominantly a bank-dominated market, but there are some changes afoot. So if I think about the Australian market, as I've made comments today, most Australian companies are unrated. They don't have an S&P or a Moody's rating. Australia doesn't have a deep liquid corporate bond market of any size or scale. And so most borrowers are heavily reliant on banks for funding. Yet, unfortunately, as a result of the financial crisis and more recently the collapse of banks like SVB or Credit Suisse, it really forces the attention of the regulators to the risks associated with the banking sector. And I believe that whenever you hear a regulator say that they want the banks to be unquestionably strong, it's code for more capital required to protect the depositors. And so as a result of that, it becomes increasingly difficult for banks to generate the required return on shareholders' funds. And so they look to de-risk and reduce their assets off their balance sheet, which means that borrowers really need to find an alternative source of funding. And so I believe at Metrics we provide a very valuable source of non-bank financing to companies to support their growth and their activities. So it's an important means to provide and generate economic activity as you provide credit to those companies. But equally, in our business, we would work with and we compete against the banks to provide funding. So often the larger facilities that we provide to larger corporates are provided by multiple lenders. It's not usually just one lender. So we work with other lenders, banks, non-banks, to provide that financing to companies.
And you have a myriad of funds that suit wholesale, and there's a retail component as well. So anyone listening to this can go to the Metrics website and find out more information. How important is it when you construct these portfolios that you've got the breadth or the diversification across, I guess, all like businesses, across markets, etc.?
It's critical. I think, unfortunately, I am of the view that industry risk is not the greatest risk that investors need to think about how they diversify. For us as a lender, it's very much around bottom-up credit fundamentals. Who's the company we're lending to? What's the project they're undertaking? What's the cash flow that's going to be generated to service and repay the debt? So the biggest risk that I see that an investor is exposed to in direct lending strategies is the risk of credit loss in the event of a default. And so there's lots of ways in which you can, as a lender, take action to protect and preserve your capital and make sure that you're not incurring a loss. And as a non-bank lender, we have some flexibility that isn't available to the banks in terms of how you manage risk. And so I believe that, you know, the diversification is very important. but it's very important to limit the exposure to have to any one individual counterparty. So any one individual borrower needs to be a limited amount, and investors gain the benefit. I believe that in private debt, it can play multiple roles in investor portfolios. So, you know, if you think about it through the capital structure, you can gain senior investment grade unsecured debt all the way through to mezzanine subordinated debt in the capital structure. Or you might even provide debt and take warrants or options to give you some equity return from providing the loan. And so as a result of that, it can play multiple roles in investor portfolios. But because debt isn't a homogenous asset and each individual company, their circumstances are different, the structure that you might put in place could be different, it's important to ensure that the investors that are investing in our funds have given you a clear mandate that says, this is the risk and return that I expect from your lending activities. And that means that you can segment the risk. As you originate transactions, you can provide investment returns for investors that are more defensive. You can provide returns for investors that are looking for a higher yield. And so it's important to have the appropriate structures to enable investors to determine what is the return objective, what's their risk tolerance, and then the various funds are really designed to give investors choice around liquidity options. And so if I think about the ASX listed funds, why they're so important is that it's giving investors the ability to buy and sell units on the stock exchange, giving them immediate liquidity in what is deemed to be a less liquid asset class, being debt. Loans aren't traded over a Bloomberg screen. Predominantly you lend money to a company and you hold it until maturity. So you have to work those relationships with companies, manage the risk over that period of time. And often that doesn't meet the investment timeframe for certain investors. So I believe the ASX listed funds, giving investors the ability to buy and sell at whenever they choose, is a great feature of our funds.
So it's interesting. We talk about this, and I gave you guys an introduction to the podcast. I know you've been on before, but our discussion that we had, I think it was last year, on senior secured loans was one of our most popular ever. And when you think about an investing podcast, you think stocks, you think companies, you think growth, tech, these types of things would be really popular. But it was actually that conversation which was really interesting amongst the audience. So this is a frontier, and we'll come back to that in just a moment. But I might switch to you, Daniel. You've been on the show before. It was a fantastic conversation. We got an introduction to you, your backstory, and how you ended up where you are today. But the question that I have for you is, you laid out with WAM Alternatives, you laid out, you know, the strategies that you're pursuing. There's, if I'm not mistaken, about five buckets, or how I think about it, maybe five buckets. I guess, which of those have surprised you most so far in 2023?
Look, I think the private equity one, so if you refer to buckets as asset classes, right, like private equity, real estate, infrastructure, real assets, and private debt, private equity one was probably the one where I didn't necessarily expect to be that active this year. I thought it would take time for the valuations to correct further. But what I saw basically, even from the first quarter of this year, increasing M&A transactions, both in the smaller market, when we talk about enterprise value, 50 million to 100 million, but then also 100 million to 300 million enterprise value. And the fact that the equity markets stayed quite volatile, it presented really attractive entry opportunity for private equity players. And so one of the deals, we'll be announcing it in this month's MTA, but one of the deals that was public to private, Slater and Gordon. And that's quite a specific turnaround transformation strategy. But to me, it shows there are really interesting opportunities within the listed equity market for private equity players, because they do see it as a relatively attractive entry point into those businesses. Of course, the key would be to see what are the actual financial fundamentals or business fundamentals at each portfolio company level before those decisions are being made. It's got quite opportunistic, like, pockets of opportunity. So that's interesting. And that will stay as long as the equity markets, you know, stays quite nervous and volatile. But then also the transactions within private equity healthcare, that was quite interesting. And I think it will continue this year. So quite a popular area because it is seen as a defensive sector. We do see, even like from the most recent budget announcement, there will be more support from the government in care and healthcare, so which is quite a broad area, but that does create opportunities. And then, of course, the focus on climate change means that renewable energy infrastructure will continue to stay in focus for investors. So, like, I think, you know, no huge surprises, but I just didn't expect that will happen so quick in terms of creating this entry opportunity for the private equity guys.
I remember I have a friend who launched a private equity fund. I think it was the week before SVB's collapse.
Yeah.
And I think he's still raising. So it's a really interesting market and time to be in the market right now. Okay, so we've got we've just kind of set the scene for what we kind of think about and how we think about the world. But an open-ended question that I had for each of you was kind of just generally where you see pockets of opportunity in 2023, given the backdrop of persistent inflation, and that has different implications across each of the worlds that you are involved in. Interest rates, and these are just the top-down factors, and we've obviously got bottom-up fundamentals as well that you may think about. Maybe Angus, to start with you, I feel like the conversation, and I could be putting words in your mouth, is almost like we're not necessarily interested in what's changing but what stays the same. But I'm curious how 2023 has fared for you and some of those opportunities that you may be seeing now as opposed to things that you may not have seen in the last couple of years.
I think first up, a defining characteristic of recent markets, but also markets probably for the rest of 23, is going to be the fact that the interest rate movements and expectations are a hugely dominant factor, but they're also unpredictable. And that's because we're at this juncture where people are uncertain as to whether inflation's rising or falling, and how interest rates will react to that. So that's going to have the impact of flipping around stocks and sectors within the market. And I don't think it's certain as to where we're going to end, exactly which side of that equation we'll end up on. But what I can say is when it flips things around, opportunities emerge, okay? So depending on your view of where things are going longer term, it might create opportunities. Within that, though, I think, and look, we are believers that inflation is likely, or core inflation is likely to strengthen. I just think the whole translation process of rebalancing the economy requires higher wages, and that takes years to play out. So I think that's going to drive a level of inflation for future years. But in that higher inflation environment over the next decade than what we've had, qualities are a really important factor. So you want exposure to companies and businesses who have strength of industry position and pricing power that enables them to maintain a margin in that time when costs are going up. Okay, so I think that's probably looking through the noise, that's the longer term opportunity.
It's that quality focus and pricing power, passing on prices, these types of things, very, very important, I guess, in most markets as well, right? Andrew, I might switch gears a bit and ask you, how persistent inflation or rates affects private debt? And in particular, I'm thinking about the risk return spectrum, like how that dynamic plays into this market.
It's interesting. I actually have the view that the biggest driver of returns for investors in private debt is the skill set of the manager to originate transactions,
okay,
recognizing where there are gaps in the availability of capital. So banks and others that have different risk appetite in terms of where they might be willing to lend because of, you know, the credit rating and therefore the capital that's required to be held against that particular asset, that creates inefficiencies in markets. And so as a non-bank lender, what you're looking at is those inefficiencies, the sort of minor mini sort of withdrawal of credit from a particular industry or sector, and having the flexibility to appropriately structure transactions, you can decide, okay, I can have a low risk position and I'll a senior secured, low risk, low leverage position against a company that's generating consistent, strong, stable cash flows. you can receive a lower return for that. But equally, there are companies that have a very legitimate reason why they may want to take on a higher level of leverage to support the growth activities, the future growth that's coming from a particular project. But the risk appetite of lenders may not be there. And so you might have to structure that funding because of the gap of capital to provide funding, but then recognizing that there's a gap in the availability of capital, ensuring you're rewarded for that. And you might do that by taking warrants, or you take options over the equity, or you might enter into a profit share with the company, or you might even just be structurally or subordinated in the capital structure, providing mezzanine or subordinated debt. But importantly, when you lend, your focus is on the cash flow that's going to be generated. What's the risk to those cash flows? What's the risk to the valuation of the company or the project that you're financing that you may hold security over? And so in these environments where, the economy is due to be slowed, as the Reserve Bank raises rates and governments take action to slow demand to contain inflationary pressure, you'd expect that most companies, top-line revenue will be challenged. Management teams will have to do a lot to reduce their costs, as Angus said, to maintain appropriate margins. So it's about the quality of the management team that you're backing and supporting. But equally, the concern then becomes, if interest rates rise, other asset classes become attractive? Do you get some sort of rebasing in asset values and those sorts of things? So as a lender, you have to think about not only the cash flow, the management strategy, the people that are driving the business, how capable and responsible they are, what the industry that you're servicing, what's the demand, what's the business model, but also what is the risk to potential decline in asset values that may impact or potentially see equity not available for those companies. As a lender, one of the things you want to do is you want to be sure that a company has alternative sources of capital that are available to it, either through equity, shareholders that are supportive, or alternative sources of debt financing. When markets freeze or become less liquid, that presents a risk for a lender in terms of what are the options that are available to the company to manage their capital requirements.
It's like I invest in senior loans and then in private equity. So I like having this flexibility in terms of the capital structure. And I find it really interesting to observe when I talk to the investment teams who come from the private debt background. I call them like risk off, because when I look at the investment papers, the focus is predominantly on risks. Like, what are the risks when we underwrite, right? Like, that's the big difference from private equity guys, where you look at their investments, a lot of focus is on growth. What are the growth, like the upside, while you look at the downside? And I think when you said last year it was the most popular podcast, right? You think about this, that's like a safe haven to some extent in the current market environment. It's defensive, and it provides this protection against rising interest rates.
I guess I've been around long enough to see some private equity situations not play out the way they expect.
So, yeah, but this is where you bring the skill to assess it. But
I guess you have to sort of sensibly assess the business model, the quality of management, what are the drivers of cash flow? Because, as a lender, you do want the company to succeed and do well.
Yeah.
But at the same time, in prior vintages, Often private equity have been accused of manufacturing returns with financial engineering.
Yeah.
I think currently, post the GFC, I think most private equity firms, people that we would deal with, more focused on the operational improvements and the management of that business to really drive and implement a management strategy to drive growth in earnings and to generate value for shareholders. So I think, as a lender, you've just got to, work with quality management teams and people that can actually implement a sensible strategy and drive the earnings of the company.
We'll come close to time, so I might just finish with one question. And Dani, you've already had the privilege of facing this very difficult question, so I'll let the gentleman go here and close us out for this episode. Maybe Angus, maybe I'll give it to you first. The hard question, and the question is, what's one thing that few people would agree with you on? And this is in respect of investing, business, it could even be life and just things in general. What's something that you believe that few others would agree with you on?
I'm going to give that to you about life.
Okay, great.
I start work at 6 a.m. and I don't think many people agree with it, but it's fantastic that they don't because there's no traffic.
That is actually a fantastic answer, and it applies in multiple ways. That's great. Wonderful. Okay, so Andrew, we've got one more for you then. It's a difficult one, and that not many have an answer that's so succinct, and it often takes people quite a long time.
I think I can do better than Angus.
Yeah, okay. Do you start work at 6 a.m.?
A bit earlier.
Okay. But anything else to add?
I just like Angus's answer. Perfect response.
Perfect response. Okay, wonderful. I like that. Well, thank you so much, all three of you, for joining me. I think, not to age us, but I think we are close to 100 years of investing experience between us. Obviously, we don't have the 100-year track record that someone might have, but I really do appreciate it. Angus, thank you for joining me and everyone here.
A pleasure.
And Dania, thank you for joining me. And Andrew, pleasure.
Thanks, Owen.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. Before you go, I wanted to share some things with you. Specifically, I wanted to tell you about the 10 ways that Rask could help you in 2024. As many of you know, Rask has grown to become one of the biggest investing and finance platforms in Australia. Across our podcasts, our websites, our memberships, and so on, we now engage around 200,000 Aussies. Which, considering we started in a humble lounge room on a Kmart desk, one of those old fake white wooden ones, I'm pretty ecstatic about where we are 6 years later. As part of becoming one of Australia's biggest platforms for wealth creation and preservation, we now have a very special position in the country in that we can bring you some of the best, most thoughtful, expert-driven ways to protect and grow your wealth. And I'm going to share some of those with you now. I've got 10 ways that we can potentially help you or match you with someone who can. The first thing that I want to tell you about is the biggest step we've ever taken at Rask, which is the launch of our Rask Invest platform. This is a platform that lets our team, led by me, invest for you, primarily through low-cost, diversified ETFs. We'll have three strategies at launch, and every investor who comes through can pick one of the three strategies, being a balanced strategy, a growth strategy, and a high growth strategy. The balanced strategy focuses on passive income, and the high growth strategy focuses on longer term compounding. You will find a link in your podcast player to register your interest. We will be taking off soon. Number two, if you prefer to DIY your investing, you can join me and over 4,000 members inside Rask Core. That's our full ETF and ASX share research membership community. You can join now and you'll get updated ETF portfolio recommendations every quarter, as well as ongoing ASX and global stock research. Every single month, we call them the All-Star Stocks. You get that alongside the ETF portfolios as well as other members-only content. It's called Rask Core. Number three, our first ever partnership with a business other than our own was a business by the name of Blusk, which has since become Flint Group. Flint Group is led by Chris Bates and Christian Stevens, two of Australia's most highly regarded mortgage brokers. Already over 200 Rask community members have begun the Rask plus Flint Group mortgage broking process. You can click the link in your podcast player if you're refinancing, investing, a first home buyer, or whatever. You've probably heard Chris on the show many times. Number four, you can connect with our most trusted financial advisors. Whether you're 25 years old, just graduated uni and looking to set yourself up, or approaching or in retirement and you've got that nest egg you want to protect and generate a passive income from, you can get in contact with our trusted panel of financial advisors. You can find the link in your podcast player. It's there each and every week. Just click the thing that says financial planning. Number five, if you want specialist insurance advice, as Warren Buffett said, rule number one is don't lose money. And rule number two is don't forget rule number one. Insurance is vitally important, especially when it comes to your number one asset, you. Whether you're a single income household or a couple, and you just want to protect what would happen if. You want to protect your family if something goes wrong. You want to protect your spouse if you lose your job. You want to protect yourself if you hurt yourself on the weekend at footy. Insurance is a way to do that. And I think the best way to do insurance is through a financial planner. And there's a few reasons for that, but one of them is sometimes some insurers will only work with financial advisors, but they can also be your companion as you go through the sometimes daunting process of getting insurance done properly. Sometimes you might not even know, but you're not even covered, even though you think you are. So get the right advice. You'll find a link in the show notes to check that out. Number six, buying property. If you're like me and you're thinking of buying property in the next 12 months, or maybe you've already invested and you're looking to downsize, getting the right advice and being able to build wealth through property is a proven strategy. It might be one of the most contentious, but I think that we have one of Australia's best property coaches in our ranks. That is Pete Wargent. Pete is the host of the now super popular Australian Property Podcast by Rask, and he's also my analyst team's macro consultant. So if you're a member of RASCOR, you will have seen Pete's name around the traps. He's a property coach and buyer's agent, and he works with a select number of people each and every year. Just a note on this, this is not a commercial thing with Pete. Pete just has great services, so we offer them to the community. And when he fills up, he fills up. You can find out more about Pete's coaching in the show notes. Next up, tracking your portfolio for tax. I think you are, because I think you have to. So we've partnered with Nevexa to help you manage your share and ETF reporting, whether it's tax or performance. All RASC users get 20% off an annual plan with Nevexa. You can sync your portfolio with Nevexa's software, and it automatically tracks your dividends, your capital gains tax, and more. Again, not a commercial partnership. We don't make anything from working with Nevexa, but they do create some great tools which the RASC community uses each and every day. Number eight, want to run your own business? Maybe you already do. If you want more profit, but less stress, less time consumed, and less energy lost, get in contact. We have a partner business called Inflection. The Inflection Accelerator Program is a complete online course that helps you and a community of members engage and follow a proven strategy for growing your business. I'm grateful to be one of the coaches inside the Accelerator program, helping business owners right across Australia. You can find more following the link in your podcast player. It's the one that says coaching. Number nine, if you haven't already checked it out, join over 20,000 other people who tune into the RASC YouTube channel. It is completely free and you get notified when we go live and when we publish podcast episodes. There is a podcast on the RASC network each and every day, as well as bite-sized material that's less than 60 seconds, or those really punchy tutorials and webinars that are just 15 minutes that take you through a really exciting topic, whether it's how to buy a property, whether it's how to pick a dividend ETF. Some of our most popular content actually just explains things like, what the heck is franking credits and how do I calculate if I've got some? That's on our YouTube channel. Number 10, if you want to be a better investor, a saver, a better partner with money, or just understand your own relationship with money, you can do that. All of that by going to the RASC Education website and taking a free course. We've enrolled over 26,000 students at the time of this recording, and we are on a mission to get to 100,000 in the next few years. RASC Education is our mostly free education platform, covering everything from budgeting and automation to the probably, I would say, the best value investing program in the country. So whether you're a value investor, an intermediate investor, you want to know how to value Woolworths shares, or you simply just want to understand what ethical investing is, or buy your first property and what actually happens on settlement day, head to the RASC Education website and enroll in something today. It is free and it supports us, because then I can come on here next month and I can say we've got 27,000, and hopefully we reach critical mass where we can help more Australians manage their money better. Thank you for listening to this long-winded ad. If you want to get in contact with me, you know where to go. There's a link in your show notes. Basically, these 10 services, even though some of them we don't make any money from, support RASC and allow us to produce these podcasts, attract the biggest and best guests from Australia and around the world, and bring them to you to answer your questions. Thank you for being part of the RASC network, and thank you for your ongoing support. Bye for now.